This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I've read twice now from John Muir's book called The Story of My Boyhood and Youth. He wrote this book a year before he died in 1914. He was born in 1838, and I'll be starting on Chapter 3, Life on a Wisconsin Farm. John Muir moved to Wisconsin when he was 11 years old, from Dunbar, Scotland, with his family. He starts Chapter 3. Coming direct from school in Scotland while we were still hopefully ignorant and far from tame, notwithstanding the unnatural profusion of teaching and thrashing lavished upon us, getting acquainted with the animals about us was a never-failing source of wonder and delight. At first my father, like nearly all the backwoods settlers, bought a yoke of oxen to do the farm work, and as field after field was cleared, the number was gradually increased until we had 5 yoke. These wise, patient, plodding animals did all the plowing, logging, hauling, and hard work of every sort for the first 4 or 5 years, and never having seen oxen before, we looked at them with the same eager freshness of conception as we did at the wild animals. We worked with them, sympathized with them in their rest and toil and play, and thus learned to know them far better than we should had we been only trained scientific naturalists. We soon learned that each ox and cow and calf had individual character. Old White-Faced Buck, one of the second yoke of oxen we owned, was a notably sagacious fellow. He seemed to reason sometimes almost like ourselves. In the fall, we fed the cattle lots of pumpkins and had to split them open so that mouthfuls could be readily broken off. But Buck never waited for us to come to his help. The others, when they were hungry and impatient, tried to break through the hard rind with their teeth, but seldom with success if the pumpkin was full grown. Buck never wasted time in this mumbling, slavering way, but crushed them with his head. He went to the pile, picked out a good one, like a boy choosing an orange or an apple, rolled it down onto the open ground, deliberately kneeled in front of it, placed his broad, flat brow on top of it, brought his weight hard down and crushed it, and then quietly arose and went on with his meal in comfort. Some would call this instinct, as if so-called blind instinct must necessarily make an ox stand on its head to break pumpkins when its teeth got sore or when nobody came with an axe to split them. Another fine ox showed his skill, when hungry, by opening all the fences that stood in his way to the cornfields. The humanity we found in them came partly through the expression of their eyes when tired, their tones of voice when hungry and calling for food, their patient plodding and pulling in hot weather, their long, drawn-out sighing breath when exhausted and suffering like ourselves, and their enjoyment of rest with the same grateful looks as ours. We recognized their kinship also by their yawning like ourselves when sleepy and evidently enjoying the same peculiar pleasure at the roots of their jaws by the way they stretch themselves in the morning after a good rest, by learning languages, Scotch, English, Irish, French, Dutch, a smattering of each as required in the faithful service they so willingly, wisely rendered, by their intelligent, alert curiosity manifested in listening to strange sounds, their love of play, the attachments they made, and their mourning long continued when a companion was killed. When we went to Portage, our nearest town, about 10 or 12 miles from the farm, it would oftentimes be late before we got back, and in the summertime, in sultry, rainy weather, the clouds were full of sheet lightning, which every minute or two would suddenly illuminate the landscape, revealing all its features, the hills and valleys, meadows and trees about us as fully and clearly as the noonday sunshine. Then as suddenly the glorious light would be quenched, making the darkness seem denser than before. On such nights the cattle had to find the way home, without any help from us, but they never got off track, for they followed it by scent, like dogs. Once father, returning late from Portage or Kingston, compelled Tom and Jerry, our first oxen, to leave the dim track, imagining they must be going wrong. At last they stopped and refused to go farther. Then Father unhitched them from the wagon, took hold of Tom's tail, and was thus led straight to the shanty. The next morning he set out to seek his wagon and found it on the brow of a steep hill above an impassable swamp. We learned less from the cows because we did not enter so far into their lives, working with them, suffering heat and cold, hunger and thirst, and almost deadly weariness with them. But none with natural charity could fail to sympathize with them in their love for their calves and to feel that it in no way differed from the divine mother love of a woman in thoughtful, self-sacrificing care, for they would brave every danger, giving their lives for their offspring. Nor could we fail to sympathize with their awkward, blunt-nosed baby calves with such beautiful, wondering eyes looking out at the world and slowly getting acquainted with things all so strange to them and awkwardly learning to use their legs and play and fight. Before leaving Scotland, Father promised us a pony to ride when we got to America, and we saw to it that his promise was not forgotten. Only a week or two after our arrival in the woods, he bought us a little Indian pony for $13 from a storekeeper in Kingston, who had obtained him from a Winnebago or Menominee Indian in trade for goods. He was a stout, handsome bay with long black mane and tail, and though he was only 2 years old, the Indians had already taught him to carry all sorts of burdens, to stand without being tied, to go anywhere over all sorts of ground, fast or slow, and to jump and swim and fear nothing. A truly wonderful creature, strangely different from shy, skittish, nervous, superstitious, civilized beasts. We turned him loose, and strange to say, he never ran away from us or refused to be caught, but behaved as if he had known Scotch boys all his life. One day when Father happened to have a little leisure, he said, "Now, Burns, rin doon the meadow and get your pony and learn to ride him." So we led him out to a smooth place near an Indian mound back of the shanty where Father directed us to begin. I mounted for the first memorable lesson, crossed the mound, and set out at a slow walk along the wagon track made in hauling lumber. Then Father shouted, "Whoop him up, John, whoop him up, make him gallop. Galloping is easier and better than walking or trotting." Jack was willing, and away we sped at a good fast gallop. I managed to keep my balance fairly well by holding fast to the mane, but could not keep from bumping up and down, for I was plump and elastic, and so was Jack. Therefore, about half of the time, I was in the air. After a quarter of a mile or so of this curious transportation, I cried, "Whoa, Jack!" The wonderful creature seemed to understand Scotch, for he stopped so suddenly I flew over his head, but he stood perfectly still, as if that flying method of dismounting were the regular way. Jumping on again, I bumped and bobbed back along the grassy, flowery track, over the Indian mound, cried, "Whoa, Jack!" flew over his head and alighted in Father's arms as gracefully as if it were all intended for circus work. After going over the course 5 or 6 times in the same free, picturesque style, I gave place to Brother David, whose performances were much like my own. In a few weeks, however, or a month, we were taking adventurous rides more than a mile long out to the big meadow frequented by sandhill cranes and returning safely with wonderful stories of the great long-legged birds we had seen and how on the whole journey away and back, we had fallen off only 5 or 6 times. Gradually, we learned to gallop through the woods without roads of any sort, bareback and without rope or bridle, guiding only by leaning from side to side or by slight knee pressure. In this free way, we used to amuse ourselves, riding at full speed across a big kettle that was on our farm, without holding on by either mane or tail. These so-called kettles were formed by the melting of large detached blocks of ice that had been buried in moraine material thousands of years ago when the ice sheet that covered all this region was receding. As the buried ice melted, of course, the moraine material above and about fell in, forming hopper-shaped hollows, while the grass growing on their sides and around them prevented the rain and wind from filling them up. The one we performed in was perhaps 70 or 80 feet wide and 20 or 30 feet deep, and without a saddle or hold of any kind, it was not easy to keep from slipping over Jack's head in diving into it or over his tail climbing out. This was fine sport on the long summer Sundays when we were able to steal away before meeting time without being seen. We got very warm and red at it, and oftentimes poor Jack, dripping with sweat like his riders, seemed to have been boiled in that kettle. We moved into our frame house in the fall when Mother, with the rest of the family, arrived from Scotland, and when the winter snow began to fly, the Burr Oak shanty was made into a stable for Jack. In summer, Dave or I had to ride after the cows every evening about sundown, and Jack got so accustomed to bringing in the drove that when we happened to be a few minutes late, he used to go off alone at the regular time and bring them home at a gallop. It used to make Father very angry to see Jack chasing the cows like a shepherd dog, running from one to the other and giving each a bite on the rump to keep them on the run, flying before him as if pursued by wolves. Father would declare at times that the wickedest beast had the devil in him and would be the death of the cattle. The corral and barn were just at the foot of a hill, and he made a great display of the drove on the home stretch as they walloped down that hill with their tails on end. One evening when the Pell-Mell Wild West show was at its wildest, it made Father so extravagantly mad that he ordered me to shoot Jack. I went to the house and brought the gun, suffering most horrible mental anguish. Jack's life was spared, however, though I can't tell what finally became of him. I wish I could. After Father bought a span of workhorses, he was sold to a man who said he was going to ride him across the plains to California. We had him, I think, some 5 or 6 years. He was the stoutest, gentlest, bravest little horse I ever saw. He never seemed tired, could canter all day with a man about as heavy as himself on his back, and feared nothing. Once 50 or 60 pounds of beef that was tied on his back slid over his shoulders, along his neck, and weighed down his head to the ground, fairly anchoring him. But he stood patient and still for half an hour or so, without making the slightest struggle to free himself, while I was away getting help to untie the pack rope and set the load back in its place. Great was the delight of brothers, David and Daniel and myself, when Father gave us a few pine boards for a boat, and it was a memorable day when we got that boat built and launched it into the lake. Never shall I forget our first sail over the gradually deepening water, the sunbeams pouring through it revealing the strange plants covering the bottom, and the fishes coming about us, staring and wondering as if the boat were a monstrous strange fish. The water was so clear that it was almost invisible, and when we floated slowly out over the plants and fishes, we seemed to be miraculously sustained in the air while silently exploring a veritable fairyland. We always had to work hard, but if we worked still harder, we were occasionally allowed a little spell in the long summer evenings about sundown to fish, and on Sundays an hour or two to sail quietly without fishing rod or gun when the lake was calm. Therefore, we gradually learned something about its inhabitants: pickerel, sunfish, black bass, perch, shiners, pumpkin seeds, ducks, loons, turtles, muskrats. We saw the sunfishes making their nests in little openings in the rushes where the water was only a few feet deep, plowing up and shoving away the soft gray mud with their noses like pigs, forming round bowls 5 or 6 inches in depth and about 2 feet in diameter, in which their eggs were deposited, and with what beautiful, unweariable devotion they watched and hovered over them and chased away prowling, spawn-eating enemies that ventured within a rod or two of the precious nest. The pickerel is a savage fish endowed with marvelous strength and speed. It lies in wait for its prey on the bottom, perfectly motionless like a waterlogged stick, watching everything that moves with fierce, hungry eyes. Oftentimes when we were fishing for some other kinds over the edge of the boat, a pickerel that we had not noticed would come like a bolt of lightning and seize the fish we had caught before we could get it into the boat. The very first pickerel that I ever caught jumped into the air to seize a small fish dangling on my line and, missing its aim, fell plump into the boat as if it had dropped from the sky. Some of our neighbors fished for pickerel through the ice in midwinter. They usually drove a wagon out on the lake, set a large number of lines baited with live minnows, hung a loop of the lines over a small bush planted at the side of each hole, and watched to see the loops pulled off when a fish had taken the bait. Large quantities of pickerel were often caught in this cruel way. Our beautiful lake, named Fountain Lake by father, but Muir's Lake by the neighbors, is one of the many small glacier lakes that adorn the Wisconsin landscapes. It is fed by 20 or 30 meadow springs. It's about half a mile long, half as wide, and surrounded by low, finely mottled hills dotted with oak and hickory, and meadows full of grasses and sedges and many beautiful orchids and ferns. First, there is a zone of green, shining rushes, and just beyond the rushes, a zone of white and orange water lilies, 50 or 60 feet wide, forming a magnificent border. On bright days when the lake was rippled by a breeze, the lilies and sun spangles danced together in radiant beauty, and it became difficult to discriminate between them. I will stop there. I wanted to find an update on Fountain Lake, where it is today and what it's called. From the WisconsinHistory.org website, it has a caption of a photograph of a beautiful lake. View of Ennis Lake, also known as Fountain Lake, located in the John Muir Memorial Park near Montello. As a boy, John Muir lived with his family on the shores of Fountain Lake from 1849 to 1857. Muir Park, which is owned by Marquette County, was named a state natural area in 1972, and Fountain Lake Farm was designated a National Historic Landmark on June 21, 1990. And next week I'll continue reading John Muir's book, The Story of My Boyhood and Youth. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.